Thank you very much, Papadaka. I wasn't aware of that particular seminar extract. Quite a lot to live up to. And very good to be with you this morning to talk about the Dharma. Salutation to the noble, ever-youthful Manjushri. Salutation to the victorious ones, their followers. Salutation to the holy Dharma and to the teachers who are their foundation. Relying on the blessings of Milarepa and Atisha, I write for the benefit of myself and others this jewel of the holy Dharma, which is like the wish-fulfilling gem. So this is how Gampopa, the great Dharma Lord Gampopa, begins his great work, the jewel ornament of liberation. He begins the work in the traditional Buddhist manner by saluting, by paying homage, first of all to Manjushri, the gentle radiance, the ever-youthful Manjushri. Manjushri is the archetypal Bodhisattva, the archetype, if you like, of, in particular, wisdom, the Buddha's wisdom. He represents the wisdom aspect of enlightenment, and he's depicted as an ever-youthful, a 16-year-old youth, usually orange or golden yellow in colour, wielding a sword and holding the book of the perfection of wisdom to his heart. And Manjushri embodies wisdom in all its aspects, in the aspect of seeing reality face to face as it is, right through to its practical application, including skill in communicating and speaking and writing. So traditionally, Manjushri is always invoked when you're about to write a Buddhist text. So Gampopa invokes the ever-youthful Manjushri. He pays homage to the victorious ones, the Jinnas, the conquerors. These are the Buddhas, the enlightened ones, those who've attained the fullness of wisdom and compassion. And he pays homage to their followers, the followers of the enlightened ones. More literally, their sons, the Buddha Putras, the sons of the Buddhas, the offspring of the Buddhas. These are the Bodhisattvas, the great disciples who are on the path to enlightenment for all beings. And he pays homage to the Dharma. And by the Dharma, he means especially the realization of Nirvana itself, the state of enlightenment itself, and all the sublime experiences that lead towards it. He pays homage to the teachers, the lamas, the gurus, who are the foundation of the Dharma and the experiences that lead up to the realization of Nirvana. They're the foundation because for Gampopa and for his tradition, everything good and valuable and meaningful arises from having a teacher. Having teachers who teach and train you and introduce you to the Buddha, to the actual experience of the Dharma, as well as to the Sangha of Bodhisattvas. And Gampopa then refers to two particular teachers, particular gurus, Milarepa and Atisha. And he says that he'll rely on their blessings to write this jewel ornament of liberation. This is very interesting. Gampopa comes from a time when originality is not prized. Novelty is not prized. Originality, if there is such a concept even, you know, in the time of Gampopa, arises out of your actual engagement in the tradition. And he says he will write not just to benefit others, but to benefit himself, to clarify things for himself. I want to say something about Milarepa and Atisha, but before that, let's say something about Gampopa. That will bring us to who Milarepa is and who Atisha is. Gampopa simply means the man from Gampo, a region, Gampo being a region of southern Tibet. And he was born in 1079, and he was born into a family of doctors. That was the family business, medicine. And of course, they would have been devout Buddhist practitioners, and Gampopa would have practiced particular Buddhist practices. And he trained as a medicine man, as a doctor. So another name he has is Dagpo Laje, the physician from Dagpo. Eventually he married well. He had children. Some authorities say one child, some say more than one. But sometime in his 20s, there was an epidemic in the region. There was some kind of plague, and his wife and children died. And the life stories tell us that on her deathbed, Gampopa's wife told him, "There is no happiness in the householder life. After my death, practice Dharma wholeheartedly." And Gampopa vowed to her that he would practice the Dharma wholeheartedly. So at the age of 25, Gampopa took the vows of a Buddhist monk. And a modern scholar has pointed out that for a Tibetan, this is actually quite late on in life to enter the monastic life, to be a monk. So he came to the full-time Dharma life quite late on in Tibetan terms. But he did enter it, and he entered a monastery of the Kadampa school, the school of the preceptors, the school of the disciples of the great 11th century Indian teacher Atisha. Atisha was from Bengal, and he really was a giant on the Indian Buddhist scene, and an even bigger giant, if you like, on the Tibetan Buddhist scene. A very, very great teacher with a huge, he's had a huge influence on all schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And central to his teaching and those of his disciples is the teachings of the stages of the spiritual path. So Gampopa studied and practiced with some of Atisha's disciples. And it's clear that Atisha's presence was very strong among those disciples, very strong among them. So Gampopa begins his homage by saying that he will write with Atisha's blessings, because the teachings that he's heard are from the disciples of Atisha. He wants to pass on what he's learned that's come down from his spiritual grandfather, Atisha. He will rely on Atisha's blessing. All told, Gampopa spent about 5 years studying and practicing within this Kadampa tradition. And he really made the most of it. He became a very accomplished meditator. The texts say that sometimes he was seated unmoving in meditation for days on end. So all is going well. He's sort of rising, as it were, in this Kadampa tradition. But in the spring of 1109, something extraordinary happened. He kept having dreams of a wild-looking, long-haired, blue-tinged man wearing only a cotton robe. And later on he heard three beggars talking about someone called Milarepa, the cotton-clad miller. Repa means cotton-clad, the cotton-clad miller. And the way they spoke about him, this great yogi, this kind of itinerant, vagabond meditator and kind of miracle worker, Gampopa's faith was stimulated, was really aroused, and he wanted to go and find this great yogin. It seems his teachers weren't too keen on that, but off he went. He spent 40 days searching for Milarepa, suffering all sorts of hardships and illnesses on the way, and eventually he found Milarepa. And he was received very well indeed. Very quickly he received all of Milarepa's teachings. It said that Milarepa poured the instructions into him, like one jug pouring, all the contents of one jug being poured into the other jug. And the teachings were particularly the esoteric teachings of Tantra and Mahamudra, particularly the six yogas of Naropa. All kinds of esoteric and secret instruction. In other words, he received the ear whispered, the oral transmission, the Kagyu transmission. And Gampopa only spent probably about a year with Milarepa. It was as short as that. And much of that time he was actually in solitary meditation, just seeing Milarepa from time to time. But in that time he went very far. In fact, his followers would say that Gampopa went all the way. He became enlightened. So Gampopa's formal training amounts to about 6 years in total. Obviously he's operating, he comes out of a Buddhist culture, but in terms of his formal training it's about 6 years, which would generally be regarded as far too brief in the Indo-Tibetan, or particularly the Tibetan tradition. In fact, later polemics, you get in Tibetan Buddhism, unfortunately, lots of mutual criticism between different schools, and some scholars and teachers are quite scornful of how short Gampopa trained for. They didn't regard him as a sort of serious scholar and practitioner. So in fact, Gampopa's own followers speak of him as, well, he might have only practiced for 6 years, but actually he was the incarnation of a great bodhisattva who was predicted in the ancient Indian Buddhist texts themselves. This is how they seem to work these things out. Whatever. However long he trained for, whether or not he was an incarnate bodhisattva, there is no doubting Gampopa's incredible effect on the course of Tibetan Buddhism. Sometime in 1120, Gampopa founded his own monastery and began to attract many disciples, some of really, really very, very bright people. The word went around about this very effective teacher. And what Gampopa was able to do was to blend the kind of esoteric teachings of the tantric tradition with their emphasis on direct experience and particularly the evocation of profound symbols and so on, blending all that with the gradual path teachings of his Kadampa training, with their strong ethical, altruistic and intellectual foundation. It was also said, and perhaps this is more important, as well as being able to explain the Dharma very, very clearly, he was able somehow to transmit spiritual experience directly to his disciples. He was able to evoke spiritual experience in them. So he was a very great teacher. And he had four very great disciples. And from them, it says, the different streams of the Kagyupa school flowed forth. And those streams are still active to the present day. Gampopa died in 1153 and left behind a thriving tradition. And within that tradition, his writings are used as manuals of training. In fact, Gampopa himself said towards the end of his life that for those who had been unable to meet him, they could still get to know him through his writings, in particular, the Jewel Ornament of Liberation. So if you want to get to know Gampopa, read and study the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, which is the text that we're going to be looking at over the next couple of weeks. So let's just look at this work in general, first of all. So the very title of the work communicates the purpose of the book, Liberation. It's a book concerned with liberation. Liberation from the round of birth and death, the wheel of life, samsara, the world of tribulation and suffering. There's an even further liberation that it teaches, a liberation from a self-centered approach to spiritual life, liberation into the life of compassionate action born of wisdom. So this is what this book is about. It's about liberation. It is not concerned with anything else. It's not a book about Buddhism. It's a manual of liberation. It's a book from inside Buddhism. It's Dharma. And it's a book for those who are serious about liberation. It tells us, first of all, what our situation actually is. And it shows us very practically the way to liberation from our particular situation. It describes the stages of the spiritual path and, more importantly, the practices, that fulfil these stages. In fact, some say because it's so clear on the stages of the path, it's the first ever Lam Rim text. You might have come across this term, Lam Rim. If you ever read about Tibetan Buddhism, you'll come across this word Lam Rim, which means simply stages of the path. It's a genre of literature, and it seems that Gampopa was the first person really among Tibetans who really put this sort of literature together. And it does so in a very concise, even terse fashion. One of the translators of the book, the first translator of the book, in fact, says it's part of an ancient Indian literary tradition known as Alankara literature. Alankara. Alankara means something like adornment. Because in Alankara texts, you're given the choicest, most important subjects, and they're presented in a highly polished and concise form, just like an adornment, you know, some wonderful ornament. So I suppose that's why you have the title, The Jewel Ornament of Liberation. Throughout the text, Gampopa quotes from Buddhist texts. He writes things himself, but every so often, every few lines, he quotes from Buddhist texts. He quotes from the Buddha. He quotes from the great Buddhist teachers down the ages, especially Indian teachers. And in that way, in that sense, it's a real jewel mine of Buddhist tradition. It also has to be said that it's a work embedded in the Indo-Tibetan Buddhist tradition and context. So some of the areas of discussion can seem not so relevant to us. They seem somewhat obscure. Gampopa is dealing with the Buddhist path. He's dealing with the Buddhist world that he was actually operating in. And that's a very different world from the world that we're operating in. But always in the end, Gampopa is intensely practical, as we shall see. And modern Buddhists use it, have used it, and find it of a very great value. I know of at least three translations into English that are available, that you can get hold of. There are two or three traditional Tibetan commentaries available by modern Tibetan teachers. I'm sure there are translations into other modern languages. The first translation into English was done in 1959 by Dr. Herbert V. Gunter, an Austrian scholar who ended up teaching in Canada. Dr. Gunter passed away, I think, earlier this year. And I must say I'm very grateful to Dr. Gunter for bringing this text to us, and for various other texts that he made available over the years. He really dedicated himself to the translation of different Buddhist texts. But one of his early translations was, and one of his best, I think, was this Jewel Ornament of Liberation. There's a kind of connection with us, our own order as well, because one of the Tibetan lamas that helped Dr. Gunter with his translation was the Venerable Dada Rinpoche. And Dada Rinpoche was one of Sangharakshita's teachers, one of his main teachers, very important teacher to Sangharakshita. And in fact, Dada Rinpoche's relics are in the stupa out in the courtyard. It's a very strong connection between Dada Rinpoche and our own Buddhist movement. So there are those connections. It's been a very important text for our own teacher, Urgyen Sangharakshita, Bhante Sangharakshita. He studied it himself deeply. It's been an important text for him in many ways. And he's taught it to us in a number of seminars over the years. In fact, I think he's done more seminars on the Jewel of Liberation than any other single text. It's quite interesting. I encountered the text around 1975, 76, around 18, 19, when I was first getting into Buddhism. I think it was one of the first Buddhist books that I ever bought. And it's a text that I've gone back to again and again over the years. And what I like about it is its utter straightforwardness. There's no ifs, buts, or maybes in the dual ornament of liberation. And actually, I always find this irritating. And I found it irritating when I first read it. But I've really come to appreciate and respect and even love its communication of the plain sense of things. I remember this being brought home to me very, very powerfully in the late 1970s. In the late 1970s, I was living in India. I was helping an older member named Loka Mitra start our Buddhist activities among the Dalit, the downtrodden Buddhists in Pune and Bombay in Western India. And I had a very, very difficult time. I was young, I was kind of all over the place, not long ordained. And India is a very powerful sort of country in many ways, if you're not used to it. You've become very aware when you're in India. Well, I certainly became very aware of impermanence and death and the fragility of life. And I felt very homesick and nostalgic at times. I sort of longed for the hills, the downs of Sussex and the woods of England, and rain and grey skies and things like that. And I remember, you know, but I was very determined, determined in my spiritual practice, and I was studying the dual ornament of liberation. And in the midst of this nostalgia, you know, that was kind of all around me, I came across this quotation from the Bodhicaryavatara by Gampopa. When the hour of death has come, one's own children are no refuge, neither are father, mother, or friends. There is none to whom you can turn for refuge. And I remember reading that and being utterly devastated by this verse. It comes in the context of Gampopa pointing out the fragility and insecurity of life, the insubstantiality of life. And I knew this to be true. What he was saying was true. I wasn't depressed by what he said. I was devastated by it, but not depressed. It was as if everything in that moment was stripped away. Everything was very plain and clear. Gampopa, of course, offers much, much more than a stripped down, unsentimental description of the human situation. He offers a path, practices. He describes the goal, the ultimate end of liberation. And he begins, after his opening homage, with his vision, with the Buddhist vision of existence, of reality, of all of reality. So let's go to the beginning of the dual ornament of liberation of Gampopa. Gampopa says, generally speaking, all things can be classified under the two headings of samsara and nirvana. Samsara is to be understood in the sense that its ultimate nature is emptiness. Its mode of being is bewilderment, and its primary characteristic is suffering. The ultimate nature of nirvana is emptiness. Its mode of being is the end and dispersion of all bewilderment, and its primary characteristic is liberation from all suffering. So right at the beginning, Gampopa describes the nature of the whole of reality. Everything can be summed up in these two paragraphs. You could probably spend the rest of your spiritual life contemplating these two paragraphs. If you understood these two paragraphs, you wouldn't need to understand anything else. Gampopa is saying, on the one hand, this samsara, the wheel of life, the endless round of suffering, not just physical suffering, not just emotional suffering, but the suffering of meaninglessness. And he says the mode of being in samsara is one of bewilderment. This word bewilderment is Gunther's translation of the Tibetan translation of a Sanskrit term, bhranti, Bhranti. And Bhranti means perplexity, confusion, wandering about, because you do not see things as they are. You don't see the ultimate nature of samsara. You don't see its emptiness, which isn't nothing. It's not a nihilistic vacuum or anything like that. It's you don't see that actually everything is insubstantial. It's not fixed. It's not permanent. It's not substantial. And we're bewildered, we're lost, we're confused, because we're convinced that everything is permanent and substantial. So we chase after things, try to hold on to things that in the end dissolve away, resist our grasp. And so we suffer. We don't even know that we're suffering a lot of the time. We're that bewildered. We're so sort of enthralled to the illusory nature of our situation. Nirvana, on the other hand, the state of a Buddha, an enlightened being, is the end and dispersion of all such bewilderment. There's no perplexity. There's no confusion. You're not lost. You're not wandering along aimlessly. You see the emptiness, the insubstantiality, the illusory nature of all things. So you are not enthralled to them, you're not subjected to them, you're liberated from all suffering. Nirvana is complete freedom, therefore. You also notice that Gampopa says that the ultimate nature of Nirvana is emptiness. Just like samsara, the ultimate nature of Nirvana is emptiness. This is a crucial point that will Gampopa will draw practical conclusions from later on. But again, I must stress, when we use this word emptiness, this word shunyata, we're not referring to some nihilistic void. You read some books, misinformed, ill-informed books on Buddhism, they think that nirvana means obliteration, just annihilation, just a nihilistic void. It doesn't mean that. What the emptiness of nirvana is pointing to is the profoundly mysterious nature of the enlightened state. It's empty in the sense that it's inexpressible in words and concepts because it's so spiritually full, you might say. Gampopa continues, the question arises, who is bewildered in this confusion called samsara? The answer is all sentient beings. Or it may further be asked, from which fundamental stuff does this bewilderment come from? The answer is emptiness. The motive behind this bewilderment is great ignorance. And the bewilderment works in the mode of life of the six kinds of living beings. Its similes are sleep and dream. And it has existed since beginningless samsara. What's wrong with this samsara? What's wrong? It's a state of continuous suffering. Can this bewilderment ever become wisdom? It will do so as soon as perfect enlightenment has been attained. But if you think that it will disperse by itself, you should remember that samsara is notorious for being without end. So who is bewildered? Let's look at this passage from Gampopa. Who is bewildered? Well, it's us. We are the bewildered ones. If you don't think you are, fine, I'll just speak for myself. It's me. We are the bewildered ones. We are the ones caught in the dream, the sleep of ignorance. I take this is really why you're here. Because you've begun to wake up, or at least to know that you're dreaming, that you sense in some way that you are bewildered. You're beginning to sense that you don't know. You're beginning to sense that you are sleeping and dreaming. Perhaps you're sensing the emptiness of bewilderment itself. Remember, Gampopa says, What's the fundamental stuff that this bewilderment comes from? Well, he says it's emptiness. Again, this is important. Bewilderment isn't fixed. It can be dispersed. So it's, in the end, empty. Spiritual life, Buddhist life, begins when we start to question, when we start to doubt, when we start to doubt the way that life is laid out, the way it's put together, the way it's, as it were, been presented to us, when we start to question the tracks that have been kind of laid down seemingly for us, apparently even without our assent sometimes. The tracks that we've laid down for ourselves. The tracks that we've laid down because of our deeply held, mistaken assumptions regarding what life is and what life is for. Buddhism begins when we start to question this. Buddhism begins with questioning. Buddhism begins with curiosity. The path starts with curiosity, with doubt, in the very positive sense of questioning the way things are set up. The great Indian master Aryadeva has this wonderful saying, "The nature of existence, is it empty or not? Merely feeling this doubt tears samsara asunder." Incredible thing to say. When we start to question what's presented, is it there? Is it not there? When we start to get curious, well, that's going to start ripping up samsara, the endless round of habitual behaviour. When we start to see that this confused and bewildered life of ours just leads to continuous suffering and dissatisfaction for ourselves and others, that's where the path begins. I do realise in saying all this that Gampopa's message is very strong and very powerful. And some might even feel that it's really over the top, it's a bit drastic. But Gampopa's text is asking us to look. It's asking us to think and to contemplate. It's asking us to look at ourselves and to look at our lives and to be very honest with ourselves and try to see how bewildered we really are. We're so very certain about things. But what do we really know, in fact? What do we really know? You know, so often I find myself, I catch myself, you know, announcing something with great confidence, and then, you know, I walk away and a little voice is saying, "You don't know that. You didn't, you know, you expressed an opinion. It might be something to do with something I've heard on the news or something like that." I think, "You don't know. It's only what you've heard on the radio." We can be so sure of ourselves. And pay attention as well to suffering and dissatisfaction. Gampopa talks a lot about that. How happy are we, in fact? How satisfied are we? Actually, we might think, "Yeah, well, I do feel pretty good." Well, that's fine. Nobody wants to say, "Well, you shouldn't feel that if you feel good about your life." But then you might ask a further question. Well, I might feel pretty good about myself and my life, but how meaningful is my life? There's another kind of suffering that Buddhism talks about, which is dissatisfaction. Things might be going very well, but how satisfying is it really? How meaningful is it? So Gampopa is asking us to look, and like I said last night, this time of year is a very good time to review whether we've been a Buddhist for 30 or more years, whether we're just trying things out for the first time. It's always good to review. It's always good to look. And nature is reminding us to look. You know, nature is stripping itself back. I love this time of year precisely because of the bare trees and the rotting away of them. Go up into the nature reserve and just watch the leaves stripping, being stripped from the trees. Watch things rotting away. It's fantastic because you can start to reflect, you can apply that to yourself. Just strip away the illusion, the delusion around yourself and see more keenly, see more clearly. Gampopa tells us, though, he doesn't just leave it there. He doesn't present this sort of drastic vision of things, he tells us that bewilderment can become wisdom. Confusion, delusion, ignorance can be replaced with jnana, pure and perfect wisdom awareness. But, he stresses, that will not just happen by itself. Samsara will roll on and on if you let it. And wisdom, pure and perfect awareness, won't just dawn because we've been around a long time. You know, it doesn't just come. It doesn't come just because you've lived a long time. Wisdom is not a long service medal. Wisdom is not a long service medal because you've been a Buddhist a long time. Just because you call yourself a Buddhist for a long time. Wisdom arises only through hard work and effort. Wisdom will only dawn if we follow the path to enlightenment. So this is what Gampopa turns to next. In fact, the rest of the Jewel of Liberation is about just this. How to gain enlightenment. How to gain liberation. How to end bewilderment and suffering through the arising of wisdom, through the arising of jnana, of wisdom awareness. That's what this whole book is about. And Gampopa tells us, in fact, that the rest of his book falls under six main headings. There are many more chapters than that, but there are six headings. It's one of the features of this book. There's all sorts of subheadings and sub-subheadings, but here are the six main headings he gives in his first chapter. First of all, there's the motive for enlightenment, which is Tathagatagarbha. I'll say more about that in a moment. Then there is the working basis for liberation, which is the most precious human body. Thirdly, there's the contributory cause for liberation, which are the spiritual friends. Fourthly, there are the methods for liberation, which are the instructions of the spiritual friends. Fifthly, there's the result of following the path, the fruit, which is the attainment of the body of enlightenment, the body of the Buddha. And sixthly, there is the activity which ensues, which is the spontaneous, compassionate activity to benefit others. So, to conclude this morning's talk, I want to look at the first of these, the motive for attaining enlightenment, the motive for liberation, which is called Tathagatagarbha. Now the word Tathagatagarbha, I'm deliberately giving the Sanskrit, is one of those rich and interesting Buddhist terms that you can't really translate into one English phrase. It's also, I think, can be one of those Buddhist terms that can create quite a bit of confusion. Gampopa isn't confused at all. But I know some people can get confused with this term. But it's a very rich term. So there's two parts to it. Tathagata and Garbha. So Tathagata means thus gone. Or gone thus. And it's an epithet of the Buddha, of the Enlightened One himself. The Buddha, the Enlightened One, has gone beyond all suffering. He's gone beyond all bewilderment and confusion. And his state is so extraordinary that we can't put it into words. So early Buddhist texts describe the Buddha as being trackless. Trying to track and trace the Buddha, the Enlightened One, is in fact like trying to trace the tracks left by birds in the sky. There are no marks, there are no traces left. So because the Buddha has gone beyond all comprehension, because wisdom and compassion in the fullest sense are so extraordinary, all they say is he's gone thus, he's thus gone. He is the Tathagata. So that's the first part, Tathagata. And then Garbha. Garbha has many meanings. It can mean seed, it can mean embryo, it can mean the inner part of something, it can mean essence, in the sense of the most special part or heart of something. So Tathagatagarbha can mean something like the seed of the Tathagata, in the sense of the seed of the Buddha, or the embryo of the Tathagata, the embryo of the Buddha, or the essence of the Buddha, the essence of the Tathagata. So just bear those meanings in mind as I read from Gampopa. However, if you wonder whether dejected people like ourselves, Gampopa puts these little words in, dejected, we do get dejected sometimes, don't we? And, you know, perhaps he has in mind his description of the bewilderment and suffering of samsara. We can think, oh dear, it's a bit of a situation. Yeah, I am really bewildered and lost. I don't know what to do. I'm confused. So, however, if you wonder whether dejected people like ourselves will ever attain by our own efforts this perfect enlightenment, you may be reassured by remembering that if enlightenment can be won by effort, it must be within our reach. For in all beings like ourselves, the Buddha motive, the Tathagata Garbha, is present. So really lovely. He has this, we can gain enlightenment if we make the effort to do so. And we can make the effort to do so because we possess the Buddha motive, the Tathagata Garbha, that is present within us. So if you've been thinking that Gampopa's vision of life, which has emphasized our bewilderment and suffering, is a bit one-sided, here is his vision, the Buddhist vision, of our deep and extraordinarily rich potential. Yes, we human beings, we living beings, are in a difficult situation. We are confused and bewildered. We suffer. If you feel okay yourself, just look around you. Look at the world. Whatever, there is much, much more to us than that bewilderment, that confusion, and that suffering. There's something in us, something deep within us, that in some way is of the same nature of the Buddha himself. Remember earlier on, Gampopa told us that the ultimate nature of both samsara and nirvana is emptiness. In other words, neither of them, neither samsara or nirvana, has a fixed and permanent nature. If this was not the case, we could never be liberated from suffering and bewilderment. It would be impossible if that had a fixed and permanent nature. And nirvana, liberation, wisdom, could never be attained. Spiritual growth and movement would not be possible. Gampopa goes even further when he starts to explain this Tathagata Garbha, this Buddha motive. He identifies, he's following Indian Buddhist tradition, he identifies shunyata, emptiness, with what is called the Dharmakaya. I'm sorry to keep bringing up all this Buddhist technical language, but it is there in the text, and you know, we have to relate to it. He identifies emptiness with what's called the Dharmakaya, which literally means here something like the body of truth or the body of reality. And what it really refers to, this Dharmakaya, is the essential nature of the Buddha as reality, as the Buddha as one with reality, as it were. So Gampopa says, if emptiness, shunyata, pervades all beings, whether they're in samsara or nirvana, that must also mean that the Dharmakaya, the essential nature of the Buddha, must also pervade all beings. This actually is you find this beautifully put in East Asian Buddhism. There's a Buddhist text called The Awakening of Faith in the Mahayana. And in that text, they have a lovely image. The image they use is that samsara and nirvana mutually perfume one another, mutually perfume and influence one another. The enlightened state and the unenlightened state mysteriously perfume and influence one another. Nirvana in some mysterious way perfumes samsara. Samsara perfumes nirvana. Buddhas perfume sentient beings. You can, you know, get a little whiff of their very pleasing scent sometimes. And sentient beings perfume Buddhas. There's a mutual influence, or putting it in another way, there's a resonance between ourselves and the Buddha. There's a resonance between ourselves and the enlightened state. And this all goes back. Some people think, oh, this is all wonderful, late developed Buddhist metaphysics and all the rest of it. But it actually goes back to a very ancient story of the Buddha. It goes back to the earliest days of Buddhism and the most basic Buddhist scriptures. After the Buddha's great liberation, his great enlightenment, he had a moment of doubt about whether or not what he'd discovered, the liberation that he'd attained, whether it could really be communicated to others. And then it said he had a great vision. It said he looked out with his Buddha eye, his eye of enlightenment, and he had this great vision, which he doesn't really describe in concept at all. He gives us an image. It's the only way he can communicate this extraordinary vision. And the vision of living beings, of us, is the vision of a great, a vast lake. And all beings are like lotuses, different coloured lotuses, red and white and blue lotuses, growing in this great lake. Some are under the water. Their buds are tightly shut. They're in the mud. Others are pushing forth, pushing up out of the mud. They're opening their petals to the sunlight. They're in different sort of stages of relationship to the sunlight, but they are all lotuses. They are all growing beings. And the texts say that when he saw this, what arose, and again I'm going to use an ancient Buddhist term, what arose was anukampa, which literally means to tremble with, to tremble with. The Buddha's actual full realization of enlightenment trembled with the Buddha potential in all beings. Then he knew he could teach and communicate. People would understand. And it said that this is what the Buddha's compassion, what the Buddha's love really is. It's not looking down at others, you know, looking down on the suffering multitude. It's not that. It's not that. It's seeing and trembling with and resonating with the Buddha potential, their potential for enlightenment in all beings. Put it in, translating it into very ordinary speech, if you like, what the Buddha sees, what he connects with, is the dignity of every single living being. So Gampopa, in his own way, he's following his tradition, is expressing that deep faith in living beings. We're not just lost and bewildered and stupid and miserable. We have vast, infinite riches and possibilities. We have vast potential. We have this extraordinary potential. We can realize nothing less than Buddhahood itself. The fullness of wisdom and compassion is available to us. Freedom, liberation, happiness, bliss, meaning are all possibilities for us. And that potential is really the essential part of us. That's what we really are. My own teacher, our own teacher, Sangharakshita, used to speak of this in sort of evolutionary terms. He tried to communicate it kind of using the language of evolution. He said in one lecture, the nature of living beings is that they want to grow. They want to fulfill themselves. They want to evolve. Life wants to evolve. It wants to become. In human beings, that can only be done consciously. We can't be carried along by nature. If we want to grow and unfold, if we want to become, if we want to fulfill that life moving through us, we have to consciously develop our heart, our minds. We have to develop wisdom and compassion. And if we don't, that is painful. That is the real dukkha. That is the real suffering. Resisting or trying to go against this movement towards liberation. We have minds, we have hearts that will only, in the end, be satisfied by becoming a Buddha. This is the Buddhist vision, this is Gampopa's vision. So I mentioned when I spoke of the Buddha's vision, I spoke of, referred to the fact that the lotuses are in different stages of development. And Gampopa, in his text, following Indo-Tibetan Buddhist tradition, speaks of people in different kinds of relationship to their Buddha potential. Some are sort of cut off from it. It's very distant. Others, they have some contact with it. Others have a very close connection with it. Others have woken up to it fully. I'm not going to go into that, because the basic point that Gampopa makes is that we can all wake up to our Buddha nature, our Buddha potential. Everybody has that potential. Everybody can develop that potential. Everybody can live from that potential. So as well as reflecting on bewilderment and dissatisfaction in the coming days, it's worth reflecting on your Buddha potential and trying to see where that motive for liberation arises. Just a few suggestions. It can arise in some strange places. If you're feeling very dissatisfied with yourself and your life, well, maybe that is the Buddha potential making itself known. If you're feeling a real longing for enlightenment, a real longing for meaning, that could be the Buddha potential making itself known. If you find yourself expressing kindness and generosity and compassion, well, yes, that would be the Buddha potential expressing itself. If you feel ashamed of yourself, if you notice, if you remember things that you've done where you've hurt somebody or you've let somebody down or you've told a fib or something like that and you feel ashamed, that could be the Buddha potential making itself known. In so many ways, it's trying to break through. And it's important to notice the way it's trying to break through and base your life on its manifestations. Look for it and live for it. Live from it. For this is what Gampopa wants us to do. And it's what the Buddha and all the great Buddhist masters down the ages want us to do. They want us to live from the Buddha seed. They want us to live from the Buddha potential. And that means working on ourselves. This is something that will come up repeatedly throughout the Dual Ornament of Liberation. Working on ourselves, making spiritual life. Remember, wisdom isn't a long service medal. It doesn't arise by itself. Samsara is notorious for being without end. In one place, Gampopa says, enlightenment is easy for the hard working. So Gampopa concludes the first chapter of the Dual Ornament of Liberation with these words. All sentient beings have Buddha potential. Consider these examples. From silver ore we can produce silver. From the sesame seed we can produce oil. From milk we can produce butter. Likewise, sentient beings can become Buddhas. In a later chapter, Gampopa points out that the silver, the oil, the butter can only be produced through working the material. It doesn't happen by itself. In the same way, we can only become Buddhas if we work on ourselves through thorough spiritual training. Where we work on ourselves, the place where we work, is nothing other than in our most precious human existence. That's the place where we work. That, says Gampopa, is the working basis for our spiritual lives. So tomorrow we'll have a good look at the working basis, our precious human life. Thank you.